Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, Coming Home, how U.S. and British troops are welcomed when they return home. But first, we turn to Capitol Hill, where Congress is up against August recess deadlines. The House could wrap up business this week, the Senate the following week. So what about health care or the $636 billion defense appropriation measure in the House, the first one to include the costs of both wars in a regular bill, or the Senate Judiciary Panel vote on Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor? Gail Chadwick is congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, it seems in the past week the Obama administration has seemed to really lose the PR battle anyway over paying for the health bill, $1 trillion over 10 years. But yesterday, White House aides signaled that they were open to taxing insurance companies offering very high-end plans. Now, did this give them any traction in calming fears that they might tax all private plans to pay for the new health reform?
It is a start, especially if they called it the Goldman Sachs tax, picking the name of probably the least popular financial firm in the country right now. But the issue is so much bigger than that.
Well, we should point out that Goldman Sachs is the company that got government bailout money, but then had huge returns, huge profits that they announced just recently, including huge bonuses. They have policies of $40,000 or more for top executives with base salaries of $600,000 and above. That's what the Obama administration says they might tax, those huge health policies. Again, you know, that may help sort of picture who is going to be taxed to pay for the bill.
Well, what it does is respond to the number one concern right now with this legislation, which is the cost. We saw something that has been in the works for weeks last week, a real full-scale revolt by fiscal conservatives in the House Democratic Party, the Blue Dogs. They're about one in five of Democrats fit that category. And you saw it most in one committee, the House Energy and Commerce Committee, where any effort to get the bill out simply bogged down and went off the rails.
Yeah.
There's some thought that they'll pick it up again today, but that even that's not clear. And it's all over the very issue you raised, the cost.
Well, the Blue Dogs, so-called, I think someone once said they were choked blue by left-leaning Democrats, so they're blue. This is as opposed to Yellow Dog Democrats, Civil War era in particular, conservative Southerners who said they'd vote for anyone but a Republican because
you're missing one point.
Which one?
The Blue Dogs think of themselves as Yellow Dogs. That is deeply loyal. They'd vote for a yellow dog before they'd vote for a Republican.
Hey.
However, they've been choked blue by deficits.
There, see. And so they are the
loyal to the core.
Fiscal conservatives. And they're set up in a battle with the Democratic leadership, Nancy Pelosi in particular. How is she handling this?
Well, she has repeatedly said, when this bill comes to the floor, I will have the votes to pass it. And the Blue Dogs are publicly saying, no, you won't. You don't have the bill. The votes to pass it. What they're both missing is the word when. That is, she will not bring it to the floor until she does have that headcount. Now, there has been a lot of talk that if it isn't by the end of this week, it's a great blow to the president and the Democrats. But I'm hearing from a lot of Democrats that that may well not be the case. The moderates want a chance to take this home and try to sell it to their constituents and to explain it. They know that August is going to be a very tough month. They're going to be hit hard by advertising from every business group with an interest in this, every political group that sees political advantage. It's going to be people watching television are going to be hard-pressed to see any ad that isn't related to this for the month of August.
Yeah. Well, what about President Obama's leadership on the health bill? It's been said in the last week that he himself took it off the radar by injecting himself into the discussion over the Cambridge situation between a professor and a policeman and race, and that he himself took health off the radar. But overall, how has his shepherding of it been?
Well, I think he faces a very serious problem. Everyone is reading polls, and they know that independent voters are losing confidence in health reform. That is his major issue. I agree that, you know, getting involved in any other subject, like especially on race, is tough right now. But it's really bigger than that. He's losing independence. And I think it's the combination of all of the things they've done so rapidly, the bailouts that are very unpopular, climate change, that to the extent that it's understood is very unpopular in moderate parts of the country, the Midwest that thinks they're going to get hit with very high taxes. The education that's coming up on Friday, although the press hasn't really gotten onto this yet, it's deeply controversial. And I think it's the accumulation of all those things that make it so difficult for this president, who at this point needs a win. He had hoped it would be health care, but it doesn't look like that's going
to
happen.
You mentioned education. This is giving the education secretary $10 billion to spend at will. There will be a lot of discussion about that, and we'll check back in with Gail Chadwick to see how it goes. Gail Chadwick, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Thanks as always.
You're welcome.
In the last week, the Pentagon announced the names of 24 Americans killed in Iraq and Afghanistan. At least 30 U.S. troops have died in Afghanistan so far this month, making it the most deadly month of that war. Some family members complained bitterly that their loved ones took a backseat to coverage of Michael Jackson. Why aren't we seeing more of the fallen, given that we are now allowed to see it? During the Vietnam War, images of flag-draped cases returning to Dover Air Force Base became a symbol of that war. Leaders began asking, would a military action pass the Dover test? The media was banned from Dover during the Gulf War, but that ban was lifted in April by the Obama administration, which has also been flying family members to Dover for what's called a transfer. What happens there? USA Today reporter Rick Hampson joins us now. Rick, you say, first of all, families who do attend these transfers are asked if media can also attend. Three-quarters say yes. The remains of the troops are removed from C-17 transport planes and then transferred to a truck, a simple truck that you write looked like a bread truck.
I use that expression, the bread truck, because it was mentioned by the brother of one of the privates whose remains are being transferred. And as you know, Robin, sometimes at the most stressful moments, odd ideas pop into your head, odd connections. And here he is for this very solemn transfer with a lot of ritual. And he looks at this white truck sitting there to receive his brother's remains, and he thinks, it looks like a bread truck. And of course it does. It's functional because it can receive up to 5 of these transfer cases. But he thinks, it looks like a bread truck. I think it symbolizes the sort of functional nature of this. This is not a ceremony. There's no taps. It's just to do a job simply and honorably.
Well, you write, everything is functional. No speeches, no music or dress blues. There are carry teams, and they wear camouflage fatigues, combat boots, black berets. But there is one concession to ceremony, you write?
The Army carry team all wear white gloves.
Right. Well, tell us more about the two troops that are coming home on the day that you're there.
On that day, there were two returning Army privates. One was a 20-year-old guy from Washington State named Aaron Fairbairn, and the other 19-year-old Justin Casillas, who came from Northern California. They had actually met on the first day of basic training down in Fort Benning, Georgia. Then they were assigned together to Fort Richardson up in Alaska, and they both died together in Afghanistan on the 4th of July.
And the family's privacy is protected while there. They can be shielded from the media. But you spoke to them, including Bo Beck, that's Aaron Fairbairn's half-brother, the one you mentioned who looked at this white truck that was receiving his brother's remains and came up with this image. As we said, everything's very functional. How did that affect him?
He, like all of us on the tarmac that night, were struck by the extreme honor with which the most simple movements were carried out. Imagine, for instance, Robin, you somehow knew this was your last day of life, and imagine how you might think about opening your front door the last time. And this is how the cases are carried, slowly, solemnly, in an exaggerated, almost agonizingly slow way, to just sort of get across how important this small moment is. And you would look at it, and I suppose if you were a master of ritual, you would say, well, where's the taps? Where are the uniforms? Where's the sense of pomp? There's none of it. But it's somehow there just by the simple fact of this routine task.
So give us just a little bit more of what you saw happen on the tarmac there at Dover Air Force Base. We know that it's required that there be an Army general in attendance.
The Army requires a general officer. The Marines, I assume because they're a much smaller service, will sometimes have a full colonel.
And the reason is so that people in high command get to see that everything they do affects a soldier.
Right. The general there the night I was there, a real Pentagon general, master planner. He's in charge of what they call the Army's Quadrennial Defense Review. You know, he does a lot of his work at a desk, thinking, planning, and so forth. But this got him out onto the tarmac And he said, this shows us every decision we make has consequences.
It's just a few steps from the plane to the truck, but a little bit more about how the Kerry team performs.
The family and the reporters, the journalists, are standing, and suddenly you hear in the distance the march, soft march of feet. And this is the Kerry team, and they come marching across the tarmac, slowly but precisely, and the hatch of the C-17 transport, which is an enormous plane filling up this dark runway, is down. First sound you really hear is when they bang up the aluminum hatch into the belly of the cargo hold, and there the family can see them approach the transfer cases. They see them bow their heads. A prayer is said. The family can't hear what the prayer is being said, but they see the moment of prayer. And then the Kerry team transfer in a series of facing movements, lift the case, and slowly take the 46 steps from the cargo hold down the ramp to the white truck.
You're right. This is a moment in the transfer when they see the family see the case, when knees buckle and hearts flutter. What did families members do?
It's easy to perhaps think of families as being mothers or fathers in their 50s or 60s. A lot of these are young guys or young gals. But you sometimes have toddlers out on the tarmac. You have 18, 19-year-old widows, and the journalists are shielded from them by their van. The journalists, nobody can see them, and they certainly can't be photographed. But you hear these racking sobs. Some people have to be restrained because they want to go forward and touch the case. One chaplain I spoke with said what they really want at that moment is, a lot of them, they want to see the body. They want to finally come to terms with the fact that this person is dead.
Well, you know, some are wondering, since the ban has been lifted, why aren't we seeing more of these images from Dover Air Force Base? The Associated Press always has a photographer there. But why do you think that is, that we're not seeing more?
Well, the AP has a photographer there because, as you know, they have member newspapers everywhere. So when someone does come back from Dunnigan, California or something, the AP wants to make sure they have a photograph. And the picture will appear in the Sacramento Bee. So you might not see it in your local newspaper, but it will be in the local newspaper of wherever the person is from. Let me add this. I think that if you do have a disaster of some sort, if a big chopper goes down, you certainly would see a lot more media coverage, because then you're going to have transfers involving the remains of 7 or 8 people or more. So you'll see plenty of it in that case.
How did it impact you, Rick?
I have two sons who are 21 and 18. It's not difficult to imagine yourself in the position of the families, but I think absolutely anyone, just being there on that runway, regardless of your political orientation, to realize that in one way or another, these people have died in the service of your country, and this is their homecoming. It's just extremely sobering.
That's Rick Hampson, reporter for USA Today. You can read about his experiences on the tarmac there at Dover Air Force Base, as well as see pictures at our website, herenow.org. Rick, thank you.
My pleasure, Robin.
Okay, and just ahead, how a small British village has become a place to honor returning war dead. In 1 minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We were just hearing about what happens at Dover Air Force Base when fallen U.S. troops return home. We wondered why we don't see more images from there. But the truth is, those poignant images usually come as troops truly return home to their hometowns, not on the tarmac at Dover. But in Britain, in a way, a whole village has become a tarmac. The remains of British soldiers killed in Iraq or Afghanistan are first returned to the Royal Air Force Base at Lynham. They then must pass through the nearby village of Wootton Bassett. It all started with one elderly man standing silently saluting as a hearse went by. Then shopkeepers started to leave their shops to watch. Now the local branch of the Royal British Legion notifies people. A sign goes up in the town offices when a soldier's remains are scheduled to pass through. And thousands flock to see what they call the repatriation. Another is scheduled for tomorrow. Alison Bucknell will be there. She's a local councillor. Her husband is mayor of Wootton Bassett. Alison, Did you watch as this phenomenon grew? Were you aware that it started with just one elderly veteran?
Yes. I mean, I haven't been going right from the beginning, but I've certainly been attending repatriation for the last couple of years.
What do you mean by repatriation? Tell us what that word means.
Well, what actually happens is that the body's coming in through to the RAF base at Lynham. There is actually an official ceremony at Lynham, which is only available to accessible to the families and to the forces personnel.
Sort of what we have here at the Dover Air Force Base.
Yeah, I've been listening to some of the descriptions as to what happens at your own Dover Air Force Base. And once the bodies actually leave RAF Lynham, they get put into a hearse. Our bodies are actually put into a coffin, which goes into the back of a hearse, and a Union Jack is actually draped over the back of the coffins, and then a procession, a cortege, will actually leave the RAF base and travel along the public highways.
And so here's your town. Just because of an accident of geography, you are en route. People start coming out. I know you'll be there tomorrow.
I shall, yeah.
What do people say? Why do they go?
Well, everybody has their own reason for going there. The primary reason is to actually show respect to those who have given their lives for the country. That's my reason for going there. And we have people coming from neighbouring villages and towns. We have other members of the extended family, because when the bodies arrive back at Lynham, it's only the immediate family. So what actually happens is that the first time the rest of the extended family will see that body in any way, shape or form is when it goes into the hearse and comes out of RAF Lynham and travels along the public highway. Because historically there is now a part of the ceremony where the hearses will stop, and the funeral director will get out of the hearse, the lead hearse, and will walk the length of the high street with the hearses behind. That then obviously gives people a chance to pay their respects at walking pace. The hearses also stop for a period of time for a one-minute silence, where there is an unofficial salute by the members of the Royal British Legion. So for the families, that's the first time they will actually have to properly come to terms with what's actually happened.
But this is in a town that may have nothing to do with these families. And all of this just sort of happened. Nobody really organized it. The hearse is slowing down, the stopping in the moment of silence. Does the crowd actually become silent?
What happens is that people start to build up on the streets for quite a while. It's almost a pilgrimage now. We know when they're approaching, and then we tip the wink to the bell ringer who starts to ring the bell. And once the bell goes, that's it. The silence starts.
What is it like to see the actual hearse and the coffin of a fallen troop when it's there?
It's horrible. It's just absolutely horrible. The other day there were about 20 school children. Well, they seemed like school children. They were 18 and they were bawling their heads off, and that finished me. I just didn't know what to do.
Well, you know, I'm wondering, it has grown and grown and grown.
Yeah.
We understand the bodies of 8 soldiers killed on the same day came through one day in Wootton Bassett.
Yeah.
And something changed that day. There were friends of the 18-year-olds who were killed,
yeah,
who applauded their friends as they passed. And we understand people in Britain just don't do that. And so some people started to question, is this getting out of hand? Your husband, the mayor, wrote a letter to newspapers saying, please, let's try not to let this be a media circus and get out of hand. Is there a little bit of concern that it's sort of taking on a life way beyond the original intent of honoring the war dead, and then in fact it could become something that's co-opted and maybe not as good for the families?
I think it's actually important for the families, and I think that it will remain being a very important part for the families. But what we don't want, and what has happened, and which is the awful thing, is that we have cameramen, and they are lying in wait for that moment of grief, and they stick a camera lens in the faces of the family, and they're snapping away whilst the hearses are going through, or whilst they've stopped. It's meant to be silent, and what is ruining it for many people is the clicking of cameras during that moment of silence. Mm. Now, yes, people clapped. It came like a bolt of thunder, you know. It's not something that the older people have ever experienced in their life. Now, my attitude is, if that's how those people feel, that they wish to to pay their respects. Well, that's up to them. We can't give them a list which says you will do this and you won't do that. I think whilst the numbers of bodies are quite high, and we've got, it's either four or five coming through tomorrow, it was interesting listening to your previous person speaking
about Dover Air Force Base, yeah.
About 30 coming through in America. We've had 20 in Britain this month. And when you get the numbers like that, that's when you get the higher levels of media interest. They're trying to turn it into something political. We're not. You know, we may or may not agree with that war. But what we're not going to do is to stop paying respects to people who have given up their lives for our country, and that's what it's all about.
That's Alison Bucknell, local councillor in Wootton Bassett, Britain. Fallen troops from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan passed through her town on their way home. Alison, thanks so much for speaking with us.
That's okay.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, the life of the late Brad Washburn, groundbreaking mountaineer, photographer, and museum director. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, it's Smokey Bear, not Smokey the Bear, but is he preventing forest fires or unwittingly creating them? After the news, Here and Now. The Punjabi city of Lahore is modern Pakistan's second largest city. It's also long been known as Pakistan's cultural capital, but now it's become a cultural front line in the country's war with the Taliban. As the BBC's David Loyne reports, some artists are fighting back.
Up a steep and narrow metal staircase, squeezing along walls stained with years of red palm juice in an improbable building in a side street in Lahore, I came on a cast of characters who looked left over from a Fellini film sitting on broken settees. A dwarf, a wizened, ageless woman with a rouged face flitted in and out of the shadows. The play, a bawdy, farcical plot about two useless brothers looking for rich brides. Lightweight Punjabi pantomime for a 99% male late-night audience. The author Naseem also played a lead role.
What's actually on the stage? What are you showing tonight?
It's a family problem. It's a totally comedy play. Simple problem. Not discussing Taliban, not politics.
Simple lighting, makeshift sets, a worn-out theatre, all a long way from the Bollywood glitz of the songs they mime to. But the actors are some of Pakistan's most famous screen stars, on stage as the film industry struggles to survive. To the owner of the theatre, Bilal Ahmed, the state of Pakistan's film industry is a metaphor for the state of the nation itself.
The cinema, specifically of Pakistan, has been facing a lot of crisis over the past decade or so. India has gone way ahead. There was a time when India and Pakistani films were going neck to neck. We don't have that state-of-the-art equipment as our neighbor does. It's just hopeless in Pakistan.
Bilal's theatre has already had one bomb attack this year as the Taliban try to close him down. But in this Islamic country, he faces censors too, checking that his dancing girls are fully covered up as they push the limits of suggestive moves.
There is a department in the government which actually go through the script, and there's like a proper censor rehearsal in which government officials come, they watch the whole play, and then, you know, they decide which scene is to be taken off and which not.
New and more irreverent TV channels play their part too in this war. In a satire against the Taliban, jokes range from the Taliban's most popular woman singer being shown sitting with her back to the audience in complete silence, to domestic tips on cleaning your Kalashnikov. The show is put on by the country's leading comedy impresario, Yunus Butt, as a specific response to the extremism of the Taliban.
Voice of Al-Qaeda.
That is the best form of fighting terrorism, to expose them. So all peoples, normal peoples, general public, have no sympathy for them. That is the only way we can isolate them, and then we can fight with them.
They want people to behave or act the way they think Islam is. As far as their thinking of Islam is concerned, there is no music there, there is no arts there, there is no culture.
Another leading force on this new cultural front line is Usman Pirzada. What the theatre does with farce and TV with satire, he does with music, drama and poetry, believing the way of Islam to be liberating and found in the heart, not restricting and ordered by mullahs. His cafe has been bombed too, but when three bombs hit his international arts festival last year, he was amazed by the response of the audience the next night.
They came to see. They brought even small little babies to show their solidarity, because the Rohoris kind of feel very proud of this festival that we had built up over a period of so many years against all odds, you know.
In his cafe, he puts on live jazz as often as Sufi music. But despite wide international taste, he's finding it hard to get commercial sponsors for the festival this year. The threat of violence and the economic downturn close another door just when it's needed most.
This is the moment that people need the arts. This is the moment that people need music to relax. This is the moment people need to see drama. You see, when a society is in conflict, that's the time great literature is written. That's the time when people are pushed against the wall. That's the time they start writing.
That report on the cultural front line being drawn in Lahore, Pakistan, came to us from the BBC's David Loyne. You're listening to Here and Now. Welcome back.
This is Smokey and his pals, the Sons of the Pioneers, asking you to always remember, only you can prevent forest and woods fires.
Smokey the Bear, Smokey the Bear.
Smokey Bear turned 65 this summer, still wearing his blue jeans and Forest Ranger hat. Smokey was first created to help preserve wood during World War II, and his campaign to prevent forest fires is America's longest-running public service campaign ever. But some say it's time for Smokey to retire, that in fact he may be doing more harm than good. What? John McCarthy works on forest and fire policy for the Wilderness Society in Boise, Idaho. John, explain your thoughts about Smokey.
Well, Smokey's done a lot of great work over the years, but only part of his message really works, and that's that only you can prevent campfires from running loose. You can't prevent fires, nor do you want to prevent fires.
Well, but you say Smokey the Bear and his message has sort of demonized the idea of fires when people like you believe that some fires are good for forestry. In fact, one forestry professor in Montana, who's testified before Congress, says that today's forest conditions, meaning that forests are more fire-prone, are a direct result of Smokey's campaign. Tell us more about that.
Well, over the years, we've tried to put out all fires. And fire, as part of the natural system, does a lot of good for taking out the debris, taking out the needles, putting nutrients back into the streams, allowing new growth to come in that's good for wildlife. And over the years, we've put out all these fires with the best of intentions, and it's led to forests becoming more dense. Certain kinds of species have thrived when they might have gotten burnt out earlier, and so we have thicker forests with different species composition, and because of that, they're more prone to big conflagrations.
But don't we need somebody to encourage campers and hikers
to differentiate? Sure, because where people get endangered. You know, if you've got a campfire, that's where people are generally camped, and you can endanger people. And that's where we need to put out fires, is when people are endangered. And we want to protect people's property as best we can, but we particularly want to protect people. So campfires are where there's people. The firefighters come in to protect the people. We're putting people in the campground at risk, and we're also putting the firefighters at risk. I mean, campfires are great. Everybody wants to have a campfire, but you don't want it to get away from you. Somehow they got to get a message in there that only you can, you know, keep, you got to protect. Somehow, I don't know how they do it.
Right.
I'm not an ad guy. They got to figure out how to get some kind of snappy line in there about protect your campfire, and meanwhile, learn from fire out in the system. It's a fantastic, fascinating force. Seeing, you know, I was just looking at a wildfire from 3 years ago last week, climbed up this high elevation, and there's elk down grazing in the fresh grass, and there's birds flying by, and it's just part of the system, and it's fascinating. And we should learn from nature, not fear nature, not try and control nature.
John McCarthy works on forest and fire policy for the Wilderness Society in Boise, Idaho. He's one of those thinking that maybe Smokey Bear, who turned 65, needs to change his message a little bit. John, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Joan Baez is, of course, a folk icon, but at heart, she's a minstrel.
I am a wanderer Baez, leaving my head in the clouds.
Joan Baez has an extensive tour schedule this summer, including an appearance at the Newport Folk Festival 50 years after making her debut there. We thought in honor of that milestone, we'd revisit our conversation from last year. It was just after the release of her 24th album, Day After Tomorrow, produced by guitarist Steve Earle, with covers of songs from Earle, Tom Waits, Patti Griffin, Elvis Costello, and others. Now, this CD has been called your return to Nashville because we know you first went there to record an album in 1968 as a 27-year-old.
That's correct.
And I remember reading that you said at the time you were very nervous because you thought they'd think of you as a lousy, rotten commie. Did they?
No, I think they, you know, we were like circling for the first session, I guess, and I was thinking, oh dear, this is what they're going to think of me, and I was trying to get rid of the redneck image for myself. Mm. And then we all went to dinner. And when they found out that I could take part and laugh at a dirty joke, it was all over.
That was that.
We were fine, yeah.
Well, the person who brought you back to Nashville is Steve Earle. He not only produced the CD, wrote three songs, including the first track, God is God, which we understand he wrote for you. Can we just listen to a little first, and then we'll talk about it?
I believe in prophecy. Some folks see things not everybody can see. Once in a while they pass a secret along to you and me. And I believe in the miracles. Something sacred burning in every bush and tree. And we can all learn to sing the songs the angels sing. Yeah.
I didn't understand what it was about from his point of view anyway, so I asked him. He said, oh, it's recovery speak. I mean, God knows he had enough recovery to go through, meaning a power greater than myself. I heard an interviewer ask him. He said, I don't have any trouble with God, which is sort of nice to hear from a rough, gruff, you know, ex-drug head, that, yeah, he believes in God.
Right.
So, yeah, it just says, God isn't me, God isn't us, God is God.
And it doesn't matter at all whether or not you believe, you still receive the blessings. I love that.
Isn't that lovely?
That thought. Well, that's your interpretation of Steve Earle's God is God, written for you. What was it like to work with him?
It was wonderful. Everybody asked that question, partly because he has a reputation for being difficult to work with. Mm-hmm. But at least with me, he either had it under control or he was having a good time, but he was very easy to work with.
Well, there's another possibility, which is you're Joan Baez, for crying out loud. I mean, I have to tell you, we sometimes try to cast ourselves as pretty blasé here. You know, the stars come and go. And just moments before you came, there was this mad dash out the door. Several young men in particular ran out to buy CDs. They're waving now through the glass. Do you feel that impact on other people? Does that maybe restrain you from being just, you know, the normal casual person you seem to be?
Yeah, I don't think it restrains me, but I also think that only recently have I been able to take in when people say, you know, really good things to me, you've meant this, you've meant that, you were my idol. Well, I have to respect the fact that I have been for them.
What do they say, though? For what reason do they say that?
Well, usually it's music mixed with activism. It's very seldom just the music, and I don't think it's ever just the politics. But it has been an interesting fusion of those two, and I know that when I have both those hats on at once, that's when I'm my best.
Who spins the wheel? Who throws the dice? On the day after tomorrow.
Welcome back to Here and Now. That's Rose of Sharon, one of the songs on Joan Baez's Grammy-nominated CD, Day After Tomorrow. In our conversation last year, we asked her, where does this album fit in her repertoire? Joan Baez, obviously you're known for your songwriting, but this CD is songs written by others. And we've been talking about activism, but I wouldn't say it's an activist CD, you know?
No, I didn't want it to be an activist CD.
Why?
Well, first of all, I think that that's another rut, you know, that this has much more possibility of being heard and appreciated if it's not trying to drive something home. There was certainly a period of time in my life when I did try driving things home, and I think maybe it was appropriate. This time it was really very, very deep feelings about songs that I wanted to have sound or feel like the beginning of my career, but they had to be absolutely contemporary and fresh.
Let's listen to another one. This is Scarlet Tide, written by Elvis Costello.
We'll rise above the scarlet tide that trickles down through the mountain and separates the widow from.
John Baez, why this song?
One of the things is, I think for me, a song has to be some kind of understatement. I think it's usually the overstatements that get people in trouble. And this is another way to talk about, you know, war and death and life. And Scarlet Tide is obviously related to blood coming down from the mountain, separating the widows from the brides.
Well, in a way it is an activist song.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. And the album, in the fact that it inspires people, and generally if I'm inspiring people, it has to do with both music and politics.
Right.
Again.
Reach
overcome. We shall overcome. We shall.
Joan Baez singing one of her protest songs, We Shall Overcome. But why do you think it is that this kind of activism has been so caricatured? You know, we know every generation has to reject what came before, their grandparents' activism. But why is there still a whiff of caricature about protest?
Oh, well, there always was. You know, we did it back then, but we were made fun of for it. And then, well, I would say this is what's coming to my mind as a businessman. In a business district in San Francisco, I was walking through there and a man came up, very well-dressed businessman. He said, boy, did I hate you in the 60s, and boy, was I wrong.
Huh.
So that's really interesting to me, aside from being really nice, because that sort of thing happens.
I remember in the 70s, during the Watergate hearings, I had completely forgotten about my fights with my Marine father in the late 60s over the war and the secret bombing in Cambodia,
yeah.
And I'd completely forgotten about it and adored him. And I get a call one night, and it was after, you know, one of the televised hearings, and he called, and he was in tears, and he said about Nixon, I will never forgive that man for coming between me and my daughter.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
That's very moving, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean
no,
to.
No, it's all right. I live my life like this.
Tearing?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, if something's meaningful, I don't know why. I'm just like that. And yeah. I think it's better to just go ahead and let the tears pour than try and stop them all the time.
Yeah, let them happen. Well, Joan Baez, I read in a British paper that you only allow one question regarding Bob Dylan. So, because you've had so many over the years, and, you know, it's been decades. But I'm wondering, can I have my one?
You certainly may. Okay. You've been nice.
Well, I listened again to Diamonds and Rust, your song about your brief romantic relationship in the early 60s with Bob Dylan, and probably a little about the professional tug that continued long after that. And I'd forgotten, or maybe when I was young I never really heard, how intensely personal and intimate and confessional it is. Did you ever think of not writing it or sharing it publicly?
Well, first of all, the song started out to be something about absolutely nothing to do with how it ended up. So it wasn't some major plan at all. For me, songwriting probably is never a plan. You know, I just start in writing and what comes up, comes up. And I think the more profound ones are to do with when my life has gone through something profound. So that I would certainly say about the song, when it finally evolved into what it is still today.
Well, you burst on the scene, already a legend, the unwashed phenomenon, the original vagabond. You strayed into my arms.
There is one funny moment with it. When I went on the second Rolling Thunder with Bob and the gang, he was rehearsing when I got to where we were all going to rehearse, I think it was in Florida. And he came up and he said, are you going to do that one about, you know, that one about the blue eyes? I said, oh, you mean the one about my ex-husband? Didn't go down well.
Were you meaning David Harris, and he was thinking it was about him?
Well,
was,
it is about him, but right, I mean, I just had to jazz him a little bit.
Right.
Yeah,
it was David one of those Harris. "You're so vain" moments.
That's
I bet you think
exactly
this
what it was.
Song is about you. By the way, you do a great Bob Dylan.
Thank you.
Do you guys still talk?
I haven't for a long time.
No, there you go, and in everyone's mind, you know.
I know,
it's like
extraordinary long myth.
Well, we want to make sure we mention something that was all too real, and that's the death of your sister Mimi Farina in 2001. Made her musical mark through Mimi and Richard Farina, also founder of Bread and Roses, bringing music to inmates. We are so sorry. That must have torn.
That was pretty nasty. She was too young to go. I quit singing for a year, I mean, to be with her, and she was absolutely as graceful as anybody could be. And at a certain point, I mean, it was just too awful. She called in the whole family and wanted our permission to just go. Yeah.
Well, on the other hand, we understand that you're taking care of your 96-year-old mom. Is she still living with you? Did I read
she
that?
She is, yeah, she is. I mean, it's sad that I have to reconstruct what really families should be doing, is sharing the time and taking care of. I was lucky enough. I mean, frankly, I'm not lucky enough to have the money to take care of my mom. And the society's no longer set up like that, except probably the ghettos. But she is a bombshell. I mean, we have our little routines, going to the movies and, you know, the special place. We have bad coffee and popcorn and ice cream, and she's just up for anything.
I know you dedicated the CD, mm-hmm. The Day After Tomorrow, to your mom. With what thinking?
Just that she earned it. You know, 50 years is something really reflects on somebody who's been there with me through the whole thing, and that would certainly be my mom. She is the greatest fan I've ever had. She listens to every note, and she appreciates every note, and she knows when I'm flat. She says so.
Did she ever worry about you and Mimi? I mean, out there in the front lines of protest?
Yeah, I mean, went to Hanoi, and they started a horrendous bombing. And it wasn't easy to get the message back home that I was okay. But she was also there with us. I mean, she went to jail with us twice.
This is, of course, Joan Baez, her new CD, Day After Tomorrow, dedicated to her 96-year-old mom, as we just heard. Thank you so much for coming in to talk to us about it.
Thank you. It's absolutely a pleasure. Cutting me down.